Hello, and welcome to another episode of Twig and Soap Talk Games. I am, of course, Paul Soapbox Klotz, and I am joined by my friend Twig.
Hello, people.
Hey. And this week we're gonna talk about video games again, like we always do. Twig, you got some news you want to talk about this week?
Yeah, news just dropped last week in the arcade community, which I am heavily, heavily into, that one of my all-time favorite, and should be everybody's all-time favorite, game developer, Neo Geo, has decided they want to come into the three-quarter arcade scale space, and they're coming out with their own version of, and it's an all-red cabinet, like the typical Neo Geo MVS cabs that you used to see in the day, and they're going to be including 50 titles with their unit.
Wow.
Versus the three or four from Arcade 1-Up, which I love my Arcade 1-Ups. That's an entirely different episode we'll talk about. But yeah, they're going to be including 50 titles. They're going to have, I don't have the list in front of me, but they're going to have very many variants of their King of Fighters, because you know they had King of Fighters 95, 96, 97, blah, 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 all the way through.
Yeah.
They're going to have, I think it was six of the Metal Slugs, which are of my favorites. I love Metal Slugs. Mm-hmm. We could do an entire episode on Metal Slug. But they're going to be coming out with that, and it's kind of odd that they've decided to do it on their own. It's not really odd. I'm sure they decided after the success of Arcade 1-Up, but I don't remember if it was CES or if it was E3 last year when there were actual shows where there was a photo leaked from the Arcade 1-Up internal booth there, where they had their FPOs, and there was a photo that leaked that had a mock-up that Arcade 1-Up was trying to pitch to Neo Geo so they could get their license, and it was a Neo Geo cab. And I think that Neo Geo got kind of pissed off that that leaked, and then they resonated with it, and they stewed on it, and I think over the next year, they decided, you know what, fuck it, we're going to make our own. So, yeah, that's the big news this week is, they're going to be coming out with a Neo Geo MVS cab with 50 titles on it. Price point's going to be roughly $500 to $600, I believe. But, yeah, Neo Geo's coming to the table.
Hey, that's a big entry into the marketplace. Like, that's their catalog. You know, there's plenty in their catalog to offer. So that sounds exciting. I still, I'm such a novice to what's going on in the arcade cabinet scene. I have the loosest understanding of it. Mm-hmm. But when I hear news like that, that tells me that you know, the community's doing well, right? It has to be a growing community because you're just seeing more and more players enter the marketplace. And you're seeing...
Oh, absolutely.
You're seeing these offerings get better and better. And I think that's wonderful. And I think this is a huge opportunity to recap. You know, we talked about this in the first episode. I think that's a huge opportunity to recapture, you know, the vibe of the past that is fading. I mean, you can barely find arcade cabinets in the wild anymore. Like, maybe at some movie theaters and stuff. The occasional arcade here or there, but they're usually pretty lackluster these days. Dave and Buster's doesn't really count. I mean, it does, but it doesn't.
Most of the actual authentic cabinets that are still in existence are usually in people's personal collections.
Right.
Or they're in barcades.
Exactly. And so, like, people being able to have affordable, reliable ways of getting extensive offerings into their home officially is a great thing. Because, you know, of course, you know, we know that there's been the kind of gray market aspect to it for a long time. You could get custom cabinets made and they would have come with, you know, software that allowed you to play pretty much whatever, but getting official, a lot of people want an official product. You know, I think the NES Classic kind of proved that, and other products like it, the SNES Classic as well. They illustrated that their people want to support the brands that they love. They want officially licensed products. Even if it's like, I mean, let's be real. A lot of people bought the Classic and it just sits in front of their console. They might fire it up once in a while, but they don't, it's not something that they're firing up on a daily or weekly basis like, say, their PlayStation 4 or their Xbox One, whichever side of that coin they tend to be on. anything like
right,
that.
Well, they have to be done well, because PlayStation proved with their PlayStation Mini that if you just throw something together, it's not going to be backed. Mm-hmm. That thing went to $20 in no time after being released. Sega did theirs when they're not trying to partner with Ad Games. Sega, when they did their own, the Genesis Mini is doing very well. PlayStation is the only one who dropped the ball on it. But yes, classic retro video games are huge right now. The II Arcade is about to come into homes to be developed as the Kickstarter ended, and it got almost $750,000. The Kickstarter just ended for that, and it's going to be hitting homes in October. I'll have mine sometime in October, and I'm anxious to see that because it's going to come preloaded with Dragon's Lair. I was never a real big fan of Laserdisc games, but that's one of the throw-in games they're putting in. Because remember, we briefly talked about it in episode one, where they're going to have an app store, but it's going to come preloaded with Dragon Slayer and Double Dragon and another game called Bomb Squad, which is a multiplayer game where you can play online. It's kind of like Bomberman 3D. Mm-hmm. But it has online capabilities, and it's an MMO basically, and that's going to be preloaded for free too. So yeah, the arcade scene is booming as far as the the scaled down versions.
Right.
So yeah, and when I get my hands on that II Arcade, you'll hear about it here.
Of course. So my little bit of news after that wonderful tidbit is a little more on the negative side. We talked about, I think it was in the first episode, we talked a little bit about how Nintendo really changed their strategy with the Switch. And it was a wonderful thing. That is, they opened their doors to independent and small developers, let them get their games on the eShop. And that's one of the cool things about the Switch right now, is you can get so many wonderful indie titles, small publisher titles, you name it. There's so many good ports on the Switch now in the eShop. And so you can kind of turn the Switch into not too dissimilar from what people are doing with those custom arcade cabinets, where they can just kind of have all of these games that they love on them. Have the same kind of thing going on with a Switch, where people are throwing games that they already owned on other platforms, whether it be PC or maybe PlayStation or Xbox or something. They're buying it again on the Switch to have it on that portable system. However, there's a bit of an issue. And I think anybody who's ever used the Switch eShop knows that it is not easy to navigate. It is cluttered.
Oh, it's horrible.
It's awful. It's probably the worst part of the Switch, hands down. The two chief gripes I've heard most people express when they criticize the Switch is, first, the eShop, and two is the internet connectivity, because it's very clear that Nintendo didn't realize that you need to be prepared to allow people to be connected to the internet and play with their friends and stuff, and they don't want to do that right now for some reason. Like, they're dragging their feet, kicking and screaming, no, into the current era. Where everybody else is like, yeah, fully integrated, cross-play, all that kind of stuff. We want all of it. And Nintendo's like, why would you want to play Mario Party remotely with your friends? Why would you want to do the same thing with Mario Maker? You know? Anyways.
Why would you want to message your friends?
Yeah. So, there was a great article that was sent to me by my friend. I believe it was my friend Simkin, who's actually He's a college professor who teaches video game design at a local college here. Very good friend of mine. And he sent me this article that was a bunch of developers talking about how the eShop is not great for them. The Nintendo eShop. They basically say that, you know, when they release a title on Steam or on the Xbox Store or on the PlayStation Store, they get support from the platform, and they just, everything is structured on those platforms in such a way where their game is discoverable to new audiences, it's promoted, and people can find it. So if you have a good game and you're a small or indie developer and you end up on these platforms, it's gangbusters for you. Fantastic. They struggle with the Switch, and they say the one of the big reasons is the functionality is so bad. It's so hard to discover anything good on the Switch eShop. Because it is cluttered. And the big issue we have right now, anybody who's been in there recently will see, you have a whole bunch of shovelware that is abusing the way the shop sorts things. Because it prioritizes things by default by volume. Number of units sold. Not on how much income a particular title has taken in, right? So one of the examples I've called out in the past is Bouncing Bob was a penny, and it showed up at the top of the eShop for a long time. And there's other titles like that. And these are titles that are usually set to like $10 or $1 full price, and then they're 99% off. So when you're looking at deals, they're always at the top because they have an unrealistic percentage of a discount. And they are also at the top when you sort by price because they cost next to nothing. And they're shovelware, let's be real. A lot of these games are shovelware. They don't really offer any quality experience at all. I'm not saying that every game that is cheap on the eShop is garbage, because I've paid $2 or $3 for wonderful games many times on the eShop. As a matter of fact, that's one of my favorite things to do. I am happy to give Nintendo a buck and the developer a buck to get something like Bastion or Transistor or some of the SteamWorld games on the Switch, because I love being able to lay in bed, put something on the TV, you know, something like reruns of The Office or something. Bad example, I don't really watch The Office, but, you know, Parks and Rec or something, and just laugh to the stupidity on the screen while I'm playing, you know, propped up in bed, you know, just on my handheld, and I'm playing something like Bastion, or I'm playing Transistor, and I'm enjoying that game, and I'm also enjoying some other, you know, content, and it's wonderful. But there's just so much chafe in there, there's so much garbage, that it is drowning out the new releases. They basically said the only way they get any real exposure is if they get featured in the news banner in the on the Switch itself, which they often do. They did say that Nintendo, if you're bringing a title, especially a title that's had success on other platforms already, if you're bringing it to their platform, they do work with you. They do feature you in the news banner and stuff like that. But they're like, yeah, it's tough. And they don't, their sales lag considerably. Like, they don't go through the volume of sales that they go through on other platforms, and they're not making the kind of money. And considering that the Switch kind of involves more sophisticated steps to port games to that platform, because it does operate differently than the PlayStation and the Xbox do, or PC does, it's a considerable investment to do so, you know, to bring your game to that platform. So I just thought I'd bring that to the table.
You would have thought Nintendo would have learned their lesson with all the shovelware that we had, but guess not.
Well, and I guess that kind of brings up the question. Is it the responsibility of the platform to basically curate their offerings to decide what is quality and what isn't? And I'm not sure if there's a good answer to that. On one hand, I would never, you know, like the PC gaming community tends to get really up in arms when, for example, Steam removes a game from their service because it has content that Valve decides is not appropriate for their service, whether it be like sexual conduct or something like that. Or it's usually like, yeah, something like that. Like, it's a lot of the anime sex games on the platform. They'll mm-hmm. get wind that it's a little bit over the top, and they'll pull it or something. And then the people who love those games are like, yo, it's censorship, you can't do it. And it's like, well, they can. They're a company. They have every right to allow or disallow whatever content on their platform that they want. If they decide that this is a negative experience for their users, they're going to do that. And the big thing,
my argument is, Nintendo used to do that. Remember with the Super Nintendo, it had the seal of approval, Nintendo seal of approval on the box.
Yeah.
So they used to curate, and now I understand a virtual shop versus, you know, physical is a lot different animal. I get that. But it's not like Nintendo doesn't have experience curating their own platform. Is
right.
My point.
Well, and so the question becomes, should they be curating? I think the big thing on other platforms that really sets them apart is you often have a rating system. Steam, for example, has a review and rating system. You can see what the, you know, what the overall history of reviews on the game are and what the recent history are. Two distinctly different things, right? Because right. when, for example, when a game releases a content update that really changes the game, people will go in and change their reviews to reflect that, and they'll be like, oh, this ruined the game. You know, in the case of where it's a bad update, they'll be like, this ruined the game. It's unplayable now. Warning, buyer beware. You know what I mean? So, yeah. and that matters. And so, like, for me as a predominantly PC gamer, I've always had access to this information. For example, when Humble Bundle pops up and I'm looking at the stuff, you know, on offer every month with monthly or when a particular bundle goes up, I'll see a couple titles that I'm interested in. And I'll be like, well, what else is in here? And so I'll go look, you know, what are the reviews on Steam for this game? Oh, mostly positive. Okay, cool. I'll give it a try. You know, I'm only paying.
Yes, but I guarantee you what's going through the minds of these developers that make this shitware is that they're putting, you know, they're 80% off. They're going on the eShop, whatever it is, and their games are a dime, a quarter, 49 cents. People aren't going to spend the time to do reviews on those.
Of course not.
And they're going to look at it like, oh, I've got 50 cents. Let me go ahead. I've got 50 cents left in my wallet. I'm going to go ahead and get it.
Yeah. I mean, I've done it. I bought Bouncing Bob with, you know, with a gold coin. Because I was like, I got to see what it is. I got to see if this is complete shovelware or not. I bought a couple things for like less than a dollar that are not great games, but they're fun little time wasters. One of my favorite games on the Switch eShop is One Strike, which is from Cubic Games is the publisher. And it's actually a game that had a little bit of controversy at one point because they got pulled from all the eShops that they were on because they had music that had been stolen from another game. But that was because they had contracted out somebody to do the music for them and they just ripped it from another game. So it was this whole thing. But One Strike is a really simple little 1v1, like, kung fu, it's sword play. Like, well, they're different weapons. So you have like a ninja with a Manriki chain. You have a couple of characters with katanas. You have a more Chinese style rather than Japanese style character. You have a big oni with a giant club, and it's literally one hit kills the other person. So it's a couple of attacks, and you have a way to block or dodge. And the whole point of that game is to play with somebody and get the first hit, to land the first hit. Mm-hmm. It is insanely fun to play with your friends. Like, because it becomes intensely competitive out of nowhere. Because there's enough of... It's a really simple game. The art is really simple. It's a cheap game. It's been given away free so many times, and then it costs less than a dollar usually, I think.
Dude, it's no skill tree on that game, huh?
What's that?
No skill tree on that.
Yeah. No, you don't have to spec or anything. But it's what's cool about it: simple graphics, simple gameplay, but deep enough because each character works a little bit differently that you can have an insane amount of fun in bursts with friends. Like we had a tournament one time. I was over at a friend's house for a board game night. Mm-hmm. We had some downtime after we finished one game. We were waiting for another friend to show up or something to play a different one. I whipped out my Switch, set it down, and the next thing I know, we had a classic 90s era, whoever wins keeps their controller, whoever loses hands it off to the next guy, little tournament where we were just playing that for like 20 minutes, and we had a blast. So I'm not saying that every game that is cheap on the eShop on the Nintendo Switch is garbage, but there is definitely some stuff that is shovelware, undeniably. Right. And I kind of wish, I think perhaps the easiest solution would be to have a rating system, a user review system. Now, I know that can be gamed. We've talked about that a little bit. We know that people can review bomb stuff. But I think usually most games don't end up on anybody's radar where they care enough to review bomb it. It's whether they really like it or didn't like it, and you get an authentic review. Every once in a while, you get stuff that, like, bristles people's feathers, and they're like, oh, well, we gotta destroy this thing.
Right.
But that's, like, the exception of the rule, in my opinion. So yeah, that's something I want to bring to the table. I want to call out the eShop and how bad it is and how developers are starting to be open about the fact that it's really difficult for them. And they cannot find the success that they find on other platforms with the eShop, which I think is, I think Nintendo should take heed. They should listen to that feedback and be like, we need to change something here. Because you have
the only way to properly navigate that eShop is to know the name of the title of the, of what you're looking for.
Well, and
yeah, that's it.
On top of that, myself and a bunch of my friends, we use an outside resource to keep track of the stuff on the platform. I use the website Deku Deals. Deku Deals is this awesome website where you can create a wish list, and they'll send you an email every week that tells you everything that went on sale for the weekend. They'll send me an email whenever anything on my wish list goes on discount. And, like, it is awesome. It's so cool because you throw stuff that you kind of have an eye on. And the other thing is they don't just track digital. They track the eShop, but they also track physical. So they check, like, GameStop and Walmart and, you know, all this other stuff. And when something hits a historical low, they'll send out an alert on it. And that's how I got stuff like Bloodstained, Ritual of the Night. I paid $20 for that physical from GameStop. Because the Switch...
That's cool. That's very cool, but it shouldn't be necessary.
It shouldn't be necessary, and that's kind of the whole point that I'm making here, is like the eShop should be much more manageable, and I should be able to rely on my wish list in the eShop to see... Like, I want Nintendo to email me when something on my wish list is on sale. Steam does. I throw stuff on my wish list on Steam all the time just to kind of keep a general eye on. And
I want to be able to message my friends when I see them online. What's the purpose of having friends anyway?
Right? Well, in Animal Crossing, you can visit each other's islands. Okay. Well, anyway, that's a whole other can of worms we'll get into some other time. Anyway, so that's our news for the week for both of us. Twig, what have you been playing lately, man?
Well, you know, I'm primarily going to be bringing retro to the show every week. I mean, occasionally I'm gonna power up my current-gen consoles, but I'm going retro again this week, and I'm revisiting a Genesis game that was way ahead of its time back in the 90s, and with the sprite animations and the color palette, still it still holds pretty strong today, and that's Comics Zone. Comics with an X. The general story about this game is you're a comic artist, and you draw the villain, and somehow the villain comes to life and puts you in the panels of the comics, and you have to battle your way through the various panels of this comic book, fighting all of the villains and everything. And the colors are amazing. The way it's drawn, the art style is amazing. The sprite looks great. The only thing that held this game back from being a near perfect game was it is a slog to play through because it's nothing but button mashing. And I know that I say that I love button mashers. I love button mashers when they're combinations you have to remember, not when you're just simply clicking one single button all the time. You know what I mean? If I want that, I'll play a shmup.
Yeah.
But the art style, it still holds very, very, very good today. I mean, if this game was released on the, like we just discussed, on the eShop, I think it would make a hefty penny just because of the art style and the way that it's drawn and the story. Yes, Genesis games had stories, even way back then. But that's what I've been playing. I'm having a hard time trying to finish the game. I never finished the game, but I'm having a hard time trying to play it all the way through now just because it is so repetitive in the mechanics. I'm trying to use the visuals to override that, but it's being very difficult on me. But check it out. If you haven't played it, it's awesome. It's like playing a live comic book. I don't know if you've ever seen it or played it, but it's awesome. Give it a shot.
Yeah, no, I haven't, but that sounds interesting. That's definitely going to be on my radar to check out. I'm going to blow your mind. I played a retro title this past week. I played a retro arcade title this past week.
Wow. I'm coming to join you, honey.
What? Weird.
come on. You don't know Sanford and Son.
Nope.
I know you're a millennial and the show was out in the 70s, but you don't know Red Fox and the show Sanford and Son.
Well, I know of it, and I did watch it a little bit when I was a kid.
Okay, he always fakes having a heart attack saying, Elizabeth, I'm coming to join you, honey.
That's pretty good, because you're old.
Wow.
Yeah.
God.
Oh, boy. I look forward to the day where I have
next
to.
Next week I'll have a Thundercats reference, okay?
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, you know, I look forward to the future when I have to regretfully inform our listeners that you're no longer with us because you're old as dirt.
Oh, bite me.
With any luck, you'll outlive me. So, I play. Okay, so a little bit of backstory on this. There's a guy on YouTube called Bardic Broadcasts, and he kind of made waves on YouTube. He's a review channel, but he kind of takes a different approach to it. I believe he's Australian, I think, or possibly Kiwi. But he does this really kind of over-the-top review style. And he has a particular interest in, like, sword and sandal stuff from back in the day, like Conan. And so he's reviewed a bunch of those really expensive statues for, like, Conan and Red Sonja and stuff. But what really broke out was he did a review of the board game HeroQuest, and which is a great game. And he called it a cracking review. And it's really fun and just kind of tongue-in-cheek, over-the-top. And so I find out that he occasionally streams on Twitch. So I followed him on Twitch. The other night, I was playing Hunt with my buddies, and we had some downtime where one of our guys was dealing with a tech issue. And I pulled up his stream while we were just sitting there, and he was playing Wizard Fire, which is not its original name. Wizard Fire is called Dark Seal 2 in Japan, and it's an isometric role-playing beat-em-up game. Released for arcade by Data East. The first game was called Dark Seal in Japan. Second game is called Dark Seal 2. When they were localized in English, they were released as Gate of Doom, and the second one was Wizard Fire. And these were kind of meant to be direct competition with the, at the time, licensed Dungeons & Dragons Tower of Doom game done by Capcom. And so I grabbed it. It's available on the Switch eShop. It's under the name Johnny Turbo's Arcade Series, which is a port series done by FTE Games, where they've ported it to PlayStation and Switch, I believe. So if you look it up, it'll come up as Johnny Turbo's Arcade Wizard Fire. And I'm
going to be looking that up as soon as we're done.
Yeah, it was like, it might still be on sale. It was $2 when I bought it. I was like, $2? You got me. Because I was watching it, and it's cool. I love isometric games. I love beat-em-ups. They're fun. And I love that classic 70s, 80s era fantasy stuff. You know, like, I love Conan the Barbarian. And the sword and sandal era, I love all of that stuff. Sword, sandal, and sorcery. I love that aesthetic. And this game has it. And it was cool. It's got, like, I think 5 different characters. They all play a little bit differently. And it was fun. However, because it's an arcade game, you know, it is simulating the whole insert coin continue mechanics. I died a lot. I played it on stream, actually. You can catch me over on Twitch at Soapbox Clots, and you could probably watch my VOD for that episode it was a couple days ago, and it was brutal, man. There were parts where I was genuinely frustrated. I think it took me just about 2 hours, maybe a little more than 2 hours to beat it, and it was fun. But it was also frustrating. But it was a beautiful game. Like, the...
Did you rage quit?
I did not rage quit. I played it through to the end. But I'll tell you, like, some of the boss fights in particular, there's a bunch of, there's, like, some petrify effects. Like, you can get turned to stone and you die instantly. There's a couple other things that'll kill you instantly. And I was just, like, I was so fed up with that by the end. But it was fun. It was cool. And it was fun to play something kind of completely out of left field for me. And so I did. So yeah, check that out. Let me know what you think when you play it. I didn't know that Gate of Doom Dark Seal was done as well. So I'll probably go look for that and maybe grab that too and play that as well, just to get a taste of it. It'll probably frustrate me. But I'll tell you, like, I love a game where I can spend a couple bucks, sit down, play it, beat it in one sitting, and be like, I had fun with that. It was cool to experience that, and then just have it in my catalog for if, like, somebody's around and we want to play co-op. Because I think you can play two-player co-op with it. Couch co-op. So you could have a friend over, sit down and play it. But it did seem like it was mildly infuriating. I'm not going to lie. It was fun. The only other big thing in that regard, I'm still playing Hunt Showdown with my friends on occasion, but one of the streamers that I watch, Psycho Ghost, who plays Hunt a lot, he was recently streaming Remnant from the Ashes, and he was streaming that because it's getting its final DLC soon, and so like the developers are like, yeah, we're releasing a final DLC, it'll be the last thing we support the game with. You know, and then they were releasing a new, like, definitive edition that was going to have all that included. Well, the basic version of the game, the original core game, just went for free on Epic Store. Now, Epic is the devil. PC gamers will tell you that. Because they're trying to make a big splash in the PC gaming space by giving tons of great games away for free on their platform. They're really trying to compete with Steam. They're trying to get people to build up these robust libraries that'll make them consider, you know, expanding their library with purchases over on their platform. They're also currently fighting Google and Apple about pay, like their, you know, the cuts that those stores take from purchases on their eShops. But yeah, they just gave Remnant from the Ashes away for free. I played it a little bit this morning. I only got about 45 minutes into it. I did the tutorial, basically. It is a sci-fi, post-apocalyptic, Dark Souls-like game. That's kind of neat, with gunplay. That's kind of what appealed to me.
Dark Souls with gunplay. That sounds like a recipe for hell.
Yeah, well, it was free. I literally just mentioned it to my friends like a week ago. I was like, hey, I'm kind of looking at this game. I've been watching. People have said good things about it for a long time. It was on my radar, so I was like, I'll throw it on my wish list on Steam. If it goes on sale after it gets its DLC at some point, like maybe when we get the autumn sale, you know, on Steam in a couple months, maybe it'll go on deep discount there with all of the content included. Well, now I don't necessarily have to do that because the basic game is free through Epic. So I'm going to play that. And if I really do like it, maybe I'll buy it later. But free is free, man. You know, like, It is what it is. Of course, you know, when you play games through the Epic Store, you're giving your data to Tencent, so you're giving it to China. My data is whatever. I play video games. You can have it. You can have,
yeah,
my data.
Good luck with that. Anybody steals my identity, do something better with it than I have.
Exactly. So yeah, that's what I've been playing lately. I'll probably report back in the next episode about more of my experiences with Remnant. It, like I said, it was well regarded when it hit. Fans of the genre said they enjoyed it, but they wanted more content, and I believe there's been two major content releases for it, so I'll let you know. I'll let you know what my experience is.
Well, I'm really proud of you for playing an arcade title. That's awesome. It makes my heart full.
I might play another one by the time we record next week, so. Oh, speaking of which, a little bit of news. There is a new docuseries on Netflix. You checked it out a little bit. We're going to talk about it in our next episode. We're just throwing it out there because both of us want to sit down and watch it and get time with it and have some time to ruminate on it. So expect that next episode. We'll sit down. We'll discuss that new series. What was it called again?
High Score.
High Score. That's right. I almost said Level Up, but it was High Score. I'm a big fan of documentaries, especially about like gaming and stuff. As a matter of fact, the YouTube channel Ars Technica has a wonderful series called War Stories from game developers that tell really interesting backstories to like titles of yore that in the struggles that they had and things that they did to overcome obstacles. I love that series. I love hearing about stuff with the industry. Netflix has had some great docuseries like The Toys and the Movies That Made Us. Those were both great. So if it's anywhere on that level, I'm going to be over the moon. I hope it is.
Oh, you watch documentaries that don't star Michael Moore? That's awesome.
I don't really like Michael Moore, to be honest with you. So, anyways, we're gonna hit our break, and when we get back, we're gonna dig into our topic for the week. And we're back. So we got a couple of small topics to talk about this week that were suggested by a good friend of mine, Ryan, also known as Retro Rye Guy. He is a retro fan, and he's been a long time friend and supporter of my podcasting and stuff. And he was listening to the show, and he's like, hey, I have some things that I want you guys to discuss, and so we're going to talk about them. The first topic is a little adjacent to what we talked about last week, where we talked about like the stuff that we just can't bother with. He asks, it would be fun to hear about the types of games that you can or cannot play. And he, what he means by that is like genres. And then he has a follow-up as well. So why don't you start with that, Twig? What can you just simply not play? Maybe not because you want or don't want to, but just it isn't possible for you.
Well, the biggest genre that I cannot play, and it's due to an eye stroke I had back in 2018 on Christmas Eve, ironically enough, to where my right eye is half blind in the bottom, I can't play first-person shooters. I was never good at them to begin with, but I just cannot play first-person shooters. Take the same game and do it third-person, I'm gold.
Mm-hmm.
Like Uncharted, if you were to make Uncharted a first-person game, leave everything else the same, I couldn't touch it.
Right.
I just couldn't play because I just can't see. And that's specifically probably why I dislike multiplayer so much.
Mm-hmm.
Probably, it probably doesn't have anything to do with my skill level, which wasn't good to begin with on first-person shooters. But I can't do them. Like I said, if you were to take any game and make it third-person, I could do it. There have been a couple of examples of titles where you can choose first and third. I can't remember them off the top of my head. But if they're enjoyable and I could put them in third, I'll play those.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't even try. And even before my eye stroke, even when the N64 was around, my oldest kids, who were obviously younger at the time, loved GoldenEye. They would always kick my ass. Mm-hmm. I could never play GoldenEye, and that was like one of the pioneers, if not the pioneer of that type of genre of game was GoldenEye for the N64. I was never good at it, so I never really cared to get really good at it, but now I absolutely cannot play it.
That's unfortunate, because GoldenEye is considered like the crowning achievement of the N64.
Well, I sucked at it. I kicked their ass in Smash Brothers, that's all that matters.
There you go. It's unfortunate, you know, to hear about your physical limitation. Don't get old, folks. No, sorry, that was terrible. It's in poor taste.
That's all right. You know you're talking to it, you can get away with it, so you're fine.
Exactly. For myself, the irony here is it's an old thing. I can't do RTS games. I couldn't play them competitively. And by extension, I'm not that into MOBAs anymore. I've played League of Legends, I've played a couple of the others over the years. I'm not great at them. And there's a documentary, I forget what it was called, but it was about the big tournament for Dota. And one of the things they talked about in that documentary is that there's science that now supports that our hand-eye coordination degrades as time goes on. And
I can attest to that.
Right, and so there's a your peak performance starts to level out in your early 20s. And so if you're looking to be a competitive, like, esports athlete, quote-unquote, in games like real-time strategy or MOBAs, you have a ticking expiration date. Because there's going to be a point where you no longer are going to be able to make all the fast twitch reflex movements and decisions that you need to make in those types of games to be at the top level of competition. And I think it was topping out at like 22, 23 on average. Obviously, with anything like that, you know, human beings are very different person to person, and, you know, I'm sure there's going to be people who are an exception to that and either lose their fast twitch response times earlier or later. Maybe they go quite later. But, yeah, it's an interesting thing. For me, it was just, it's a mindset that I did not play those games very much when I was growing up, so by the time I had the freedom to explore them more, I just didn't I hadn't established the synaptic connections, if you will, to be good at that kind of gameplay.
I can understand that, but man, I mean, are you a student of history like I am?
Yeah, absolutely.
You have got to force yourself to play any of the Age of Empires.
Well, I played Age of Empires 3. I owned it and played it.
Okay. I love RTSs. Now, the ones you're talking about are probably a little more time-oriented than the ones I'm talking about. But as a genre as itself, you're shortchanging yourself if you don't give yourself at least a little bit of time with some of the Age of games.
Yeah, well, and it's so you can play, if you're playing against the computer, it doesn't matter if you have perfect, you know, reflexes and fast twitch reflexes, right? I was mostly talking about playing competitively against other players, playing PvP. Mostly looking at stuff like StarCraft, you know, Dota, League of Legends, you know, the MOBAs and stuff. There's a point where your skills degrade in that stuff, and I just, yeah, it's not something I'm great at. I enjoy those games. I haven't played them in a long time. It was fun to explore them. Actually, one of the things that I really loved was playing Smite, which is a MOBA that is third person rather than a top-down isometric view. And what was cool about that is because it was third person, it was about, you know, triggering like skill shots and stuff is about orienting yourself, you know, what direction you're facing and stuff like that. So it was kind of a completely different experience, but it was still structured like a MOBA. And that was cool. That was a fun game, and it was different enough that I felt like I wasn't as hampered by my inability to make all those fast decisions and do all the things. It's a weird little thing. The other thing that I can't really, I still play them from time to time, but MMOs, and it's simply a time thing. I'm at a point in my life where I can't basically play something like World of Warcraft as a full-time job. I just can't commit that time to it. And you kind of have to, especially if you're looking to be like a progression raider in those games. And I just can't really do it anymore. And I also kind of don't want to, you know?
I feel you. I don't know as much as Marvel Avengers Alliance is probably my favorite game of all time. I don't know 4 years removed from its sunset if I would want to put as much grind time in that game as I did then. And anything less than that, I personally don't think I would get the enjoyment out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've played a lot of grindy games over the years, and I still do from time to time. I just fired up one of my mobile games again recently. But I'm not playing it to the same degree that I once did, and I'm not playing multiples like I have at certain times. I'll tell you, one of the things that really opened my eyes to that was Marvel Strike Force. Not to harp on it too much, but when we started FTH Beyond, which is the spiritual successor to From the Helicarrier that was covering Marvel Strike Force, I found myself resenting that game after a while, because in order to play that game, you have to be in an alliance, and you have to actively participate in the raids every single day. You have a job, basically. You have to show up and clear your lane, and you have to always be pushing forward. You have to be making your teams better, because difficulty ramps up over time. They change the parameters of, you know, what's good enough, and everybody's always chasing the next good thing, you know? And it,
I'm not going to do that anymore.
Oh, yeah, no, and I got, you know, with Marvel Avengers Alliance, if you didn't finish a Spec Ops, that was on you. You know, like, it was...
That's exactly right.
If you didn't place an adamantium in a PvP tournament, that was on you. You know, and it was no skin off your back. As long as you were fine with it, it didn't hurt anybody, you were happy with, what you know, whatever you got out of it. But with Strike Force, it's basically impossible to get certain materials in the game to make your characters as good as they possibly can be without being in an alliance. And if you're in an alliance, you have to be doing raids. And you have to be participating in other game modes all the time. And I hated it. I hated that commitment. I hated being, like, chained to the game. Because there are days where I just didn't want to deal. You know what I mean? Like, there are days where I just did not want to deal with my raid lane or whatever. And so, yeah, that's a thing that's a big turnoff to me now. And it's a time commitment that I can't make. Not only do I not want to, but I can't. Like, my fiance would leave me. All of my creative projects would fall to the wayside. Like, I just can't. You know, I can't let myself get to that point. It's an actual limitation now. But there was a time when I was younger when I could have.
Right, and I'm sitting here saying I don't know if I'd want to. I doubt that I would invest the time in Marvel Avengers Alliance now, starting now, that I did back then. And I don't want to continue harping on this one specific game every episode, because at some point we're going to discuss nothing but this game on an episode, because it's what brought you and I together. But I can't help but think, when you're talking about Marvel Strike Force, I didn't go past the beta because I couldn't stand it. Mm-hmm. For the reasons you mentioned, plus I just didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
But when you brought up the example, another thing that set Marvel Avengers Alliance apart from every other game that I've played, the example that you mentioned about if you didn't finish an Adamantium and get the hero, no other game before that I recall, nor since, allows the grinder to get that reward just down the road.
Mm-hmm.
Because the PvP heroes, the spec op heroes, they would become available down the road in enough time for the people who actually earned them wouldn't feel bad because somebody that just grinded to get them, that didn't put in the work during that specific spec op or that specific PvP season, I don't remember any of them ever getting bent that the hero that they earned during those seasons was available 6 months down the road. No other game has done that. And I think that's one of the things that made that game so special.
Yeah, that was kind of an interesting situation, because you could miss an event or could just not place well or whatever for whatever reason, and you could still get that thing later on. Now, you had to save up the CP, the command points, for it. And when it came out, it would be expensive, but could get it. And that was a thing. I mean, towards the end of the game, I never got any of the worthy, you know, because I didn't have all the prerequisites worked out to be able to get in and get those characters. And I mostly did PvP as best I could and the spec ops. And I loved that there was diverse builds in that game, where you could use different team-ups. But one of the things that really soured me was when it got to the point where it was, you're playing with the worthy or you're not playing at all anymore. And that was kind of...
They were overpowered. There's no question about that.
They were drastically overpowered, and they completely defined the meta once they came out. And the issue for me is that it kind of flew in the face of what you were just praising, you know? We suddenly got to this point where it was like, in order to even unlock these characters, you had to have dozens of other characters unlocked. You could not get to them and get them without having all these other prerequisite characters. And some of them were spec ops or PvP characters and stuff like that. And
to correct my timeline, wasn't that at the time where you had quit for a while before getting back into it?
No.
Because I don't remember the timeline. Did you quit after the worthy were introduced?
I think I there were a couple times where, like, I wasn't playing as religiously, but I was still playing.
Right.
And then the worthy hit, and they just took over PvP, and I think I played a couple months after that, and I was finally like, you know what, man? I am just tired of getting stomped by these guys all the time. And it's not fun for me, you know? And
okay.
So that was the issue. But that kind of flew in the face of, like, against what you were kind of saying, which was so wonderful before. If you missed, let's say, Deadpool, you could get him 6 months later, and it wasn't the end of the world. You could still play with that dude later. And so if you got a guy from a PvP tournament, or if you got a guy from a Spec Ops, which was a limited time story based, if you got a character from PvP or from Spec Ops, which was the PvE limited time events, you basically just got them for a couple months where you got to play with them when nobody else who had achieved them yet didn't. It could sometimes warp PvP, but it didn't completely shut the door in your face. Other games since then, like Strike Force, have locked characters behind paywalls. Future Fight locked certain characters behind paywalls, or made like costumes that you needed to make a character usable or good behind paywalls and stuff like that. It was really unfortunate. So, yeah. Avengers Alliance was an interesting beast, and not a lot of games. It's kind of funny because it predated the current generation of mobile games and how they're structured. So in some ways it was very generous, and in other ways it was a little restrictive, but it was a very interesting beast.
It was.
So the other question Ryan had here is, how has time changed you as a gamer? And, you know, what games you play?
Well, I don't want to harp on one specific game, Marvel Avengers Alliance, but before that, I could not stand turn-based games. I hate it. I hated it, no matter what it was. But when I started playing that, I immensely, and still to this day, even though there's not that many of them, I love turn-based games. I know a lot of people don't like that, but I love turn-based games. So that one specific game completely flipped a genre for me.
Well, that's totally fair. For myself, a little bit of what I was talking about there, where I used to play games that required huge time investments, and I can't play those as much anymore. So I've gravitated away from the MMOs or the games as a service type games as much. Granted, I've been playing Hunt Showdown a lot lately, but what's wonderful about Hunt Showdown is it's very digestible. Like, I can hop on and play a couple matches in an hour and log off and be done, and I don't have to play every day. I play when I want to get a couple matches in, have a good time, or get frustrated, walk away from it. I'm not left behind if I don't play for a while, because it's not that kind of game. It's a game that you drop into when you want to. And yeah, things change over time and new things might be released, but they're all made available to you. So there's no fear of missing out other than just not playing for a while. So it's a game that I could take a break from and come back to. And I don't have to play 3, 4, 6, 7, 10, 12 hours a day to remain competitive in. Though if I did, I would probably be a lot better than I am. Which is totally fair. The other thing is RPGs. So we kind of talked a little bit in the past about like JRPGs and how they were never really your thing. When I was growing up, they were definitely my thing. Like, I loved them. I loved the Final Fantasy games. I have a hard time playing games like that nowadays that aren't of the modern set, like, say, Horizon Zero Dawn, where, like, yeah, it's an RPG, but it's got an action element to it, and, you know, it just feels quite different. I have a hard time with games that are like that classic JRPG style slog where you're like gonna play 60, 70 hours in this game, and you know it's got a relatively linear storyline, and you gotta grind in certain areas to get strong enough to beat the boss at this point and all that kind of stuff. Like, I get it. I get why it's that way, but I just find that really tedious nowadays, and when I was much younger, I was fine with it. And I guess it's maybe like a question of free time and what I'm willing to commit. The most recent example of that is the Final Fantasy VII Remake. I was so excited for that game. Final Fantasy VII, when it originally came out, was a formative experience for me. That game is wonderful. Final Fantasy Tactics, which is a turn-based, on-a-grid-style game, is my absolute favorite Final Fantasy game. Played that before 7, but they're both great games. And it was a formative experience for me. I was so excited for 7 Remake. And then I got it, slapped it in my PlayStation, started playing, did not love the battle system. Just wasn't enjoying it. And then I realized, well, this is a probably 50 or 60 hour game with a battle system I'm not in love with, which means this is now tedious to me. and I was less than excited to continue playing it. So I played it, I think I've played 4 total hours of it on stream, and I have not played it off stream. I will probably get around to, like, pulling it up at some point just to get through it, because I want to see the story beats and stuff, and go from there. But there are other people who absolutely love the game, so I think that's just one of my changing tastes over time thing. Do you have any
you want to talk about? Yeah, changing taste. Before, I'd say 2000, maybe 16, as far as console games go, I played nothing but sports games.
Okay.
I had nothing but sports titles, because I mean, I was an athlete and I love sports. I got the Madden every time it came out. And soon I wised up to the game is the damn same. It's nothing but roster updates.
Mm-hmm.
And although I still will crank them up every now and then, it comprises maybe 5% of my game time now. And it has nothing to do, it's not me boycotting sports or anything like that. I've just aged out of it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think part of that is, it's kind of a testament to the genre, though. For whatever reason, that genre has not grown. Like, I mean, it has changed, undeniably, but not for the better. I also played sports games when I was younger. I played Madden. I had a few different Madden titles on PlayStation over the years. I've occasionally dabbled in some of the basketball games here or there. I love hockey games, or at least I used to. But when you look at, like, all the EA games, for example, the way they've gone nowadays, where they are, like you said, effectively just a roster update every year, and now you're dealing with all these booster packs and crap like that, I'm not interested, man. Actually, surprisingly, NBA 2K19, I think it was made available on the Switch for, like, $2 or $3 right before 2K20 came out, and I bought it. Because I was like, hey, it's a sports game. Sometimes I want to have a sports game on my Switch so that I can sit and do couch co-op with somebody. And we can just, you know, shoot the shit and play something idly. And I started playing the career mode, and I was actually blown away. I was like, there's an interesting story here. Like, it had Anthony Mackie, you know, the Falcon, is part of the story. He was playing a scout who was looking at me while I was playing, I was playing ball in China, you know, like coming up, trying to work my way up to the NBA. I was like, this is cool. This is innovative. Unfortunately, you have drowned your franchise in anti-consumer tactics to try to extract money from me. So people don't give your games a chance anymore. But this right here, I would have died for something like this 15 years ago. I would have thought that was the coolest thing ever to play through my story. Because the idea is like, you would get to the next big game, and it wasn't about you winning the game necessarily. It was about you doing certain things in the game to trigger certain outcomes in the story. At least that's my understanding of it. And I was like, that's cool. So, like, after the game, the dialogue would change based on my performance in that game. If I hit the, you know, if I hit the marks that they were looking for me to hit, Anthony Mackie would be like, hey, man, you really killed it in that game. You crushed it. And if I didn't, they'd be like, oh, well, that game wasn't really for you, but hey, you'll get them again next time. And I thought that was cool. I would have died for something like that 15, 20 years ago. And it's just drowned out by the awful anti-consumer stuff that they throw in those games. Because 2K isn't any better than EA. They're both awful.
Right, but now that I hear your story about that, it makes me think that the timing of when I stopped playing may have had a lot to do with the fact that they stopped making college games, because NCAA football was my favorite sport to play. I love the pageantry. I love the different fight songs that you could hear. It had, you know, it had campus mode, which was similar to what you're talking about, where you start out as a freshman and try to work your way onto the starting lineup and eventually get drafted. But obviously that whole Ed O'Bannon, whatever his name was for UCLA, that did that lawsuit, which rightfully so, the players, if they're going to use their likeness, they should deserve to get something for it.
Yep.
But they stopped making college basketball and college football games. I think NCAA 2014 was the last college football game that was made. And that may have had a lot to do with it, because I used to play that online. I know I've said I'm not a big PvP guy, but I did play college football online all the time, and I loved it. So now that I think about it, the elimination of college sports as far as sports titles go, that may have been what just kicked me over.
That's totally fair. College sports has never been my thing, but I totally get where you're coming from. Definitely, for sure. All right, we have one last topic prompt from my friend Ryan, Retro Rye Guy. And he said, could you talk about the label of a gamer, quote unquote? Do you wear the gamer label proudly, Twig?
I absolutely do. And now that the view of the gamer, I think, has changed over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you could primarily write that up to the success of esports.
Sure.
Because now it's basically mainstream. When you were referred to as a gamer, now obviously I'm almost 20 years older than you, so when you're a gamer, when you're in college, you're looked at, you know, hey, you're just a dude who likes to play video games. Yep. You're not looked at badly. When you're an early adult, you start having a family, and then you're a quote gamer, then how do you have time to do that? You know, and you're thought of as a loser.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get to my age, you're just like, hey, well, he found a hobby, you know. But I think over time, it's become more mainstream now, and it's not looked at as disfavorably because, and I think, frankly, the audience is much larger than it ever has been, especially with the female gender.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's statistics that support that it's become almost a 50-50 split on how much consumption in gaming is split between genders. Now, what each gender is buying is, like, what they're buying to play and what they're playing is wildly different in a lot of cases. But, yeah, no, women have absolutely joined us dudes in the gaming culture. And I mean, obviously, you know, this is a topic that comes up all the time in the changing gaming landscape, in that the industry has had to adjust to that because a lot of the things that we fell into a rut on were not necessarily accessible or the kind of things that women gravitated to. And so developers and publishers have had to kind of adapt and try to get rid of some, in some people's opinion, problematic habits, and also, like, try to appeal to a broader demographic. And so that's kind of changed the landscape of gaming. But yeah, I agree with what you're saying. Absolutely. Like, for my generation, I'm 36 years old. All of my best friends, you know, who are roughly in my same age group, a couple of them are a few years younger, we're all still quote-unquote gamers. We have all played MMOs and all these other games over the years. We've all found it pretty difficult to keep up with that kind of lifestyle with, as everything you mentioned, when you start a family, you start a career, any of that kind of stuff. It's hard to, like, juggle a day job and a second job, so we don't really do that stuff anymore. And we don't play games together as much as we used to, but we all still play games. And it's a huge part of our identity. It is our, it's like, for your generation, I've held this opinion for a long time. Some people might refute it, but there was a time where sports was the prevailing quote-unquote hobby, if you will, because there wasn't a lot of stuff out there. There weren't a lot of options, right?
Absolutely.
And now gaming, esports is starting to emulate the success of sports in the past, and I would argue that younger generations, I mean, obviously there's still athletes, there's still people who are interested in sports among young people, but a lot of people have started, it's okay to not be into sports now. You know, your nerdier set, your geeks, they've gravitated towards playing video games for their entertainment, watching people play video games for their entertainment. The advent of YouTube and streaming services like Twitch, people derive pleasure from watching other people play games now, which is a concept that is foreign to a lot of people, but it quite frankly, it makes sense. I'll
say for my generation, it is very foreign. I'm not going to sit here and say I'm the only one in my 50s that is as much a gamer as, you know, people your age. Mm-hmm. I know there are others out there, but I know that there are fewer and far between people in my age group than there is for yours that are still as into gaming as we are.
Right.
So I completely agree with what you're saying. I mean, I grew up, there was nothing else to do.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you wanted to start having kids when you were 16 years old, the other avenue was playing sports.
Yep.
And that's exactly what I did. And I loved it, and I still love it to this day. But I found the way to enjoy both. Obviously, I can't do anything athletically anymore, but I could up until I was in my mid-40s. But even when I was still playing sports, I still found time. You know, after I did my family time, I still found a little bit of time every day to play games. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. Still do.
Yeah. And, you know, honestly, the nice thing about playing games is your family knows where you are, right? You're sitting there in the living room. You're sitting there in your computer room. You're there. You know, you're not out, you know, playing golf or tennis or whatever, volleyball with who knows who.
Getting, or bar hopping.
Well, and that's kind of what I was getting at. You know, like my father, my parents are a little older than you are. My dad's got about 20 years on you. I mean, when he was my age, he would have played games back then. They just weren't, you know, prevalent. They weren't there. But he was into sports, like you said, because it was really the only thing. Sports were the social activity. His friends were people he golfed with or played racquetball with or something like that. And, you know, he still to this day golfs and knows a lot of those same people and hangs out with them. But there were a lot of times where they'd go golf 9 holes and then they'd end up at the bar at the golf course all night, you know, and that's not always a great thing. So one of the upside.
No, for my personal experience, I can speak from personal experience that I did that. Now, I've been sober since 2008, stone cold sober for now 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I partook quite a bit in the barleys and hops. So having the hobby that I have now is absolutely harmless, and I am at home where I want to be with my family.
That's wonderful. I mean, obviously, some people mix substances in their gaming too. It's not impossible to do so, but it's a different vibe. It's a different thing. And really, I want to emphasize, people know where you are. You know what I mean? My friends know where I am. Most
absolutely.
Of the time.
I'm not trying to say that, you know, people that do partake while they're playing are bad. No, I'm just saying that for me personally, it was all or nothing. And
sure.
I chose the nothing.
Hey, and I commend you for that. And it's a difficult decision. Not everybody can make it. And, you know, some people are, you know, in what we would consider recovery, and they turn to things like games for a therapeutic sense, you know, right? I've seen tons of people talk about how turning to video games, in particular turning to online games with online communities, help them get through stuff, right? And that's a relatively new concept. That's a concept that's only existed for about 20 years, where you could find an online community of people who you don't really know them from Adam, until you sit down and you grind out a couple dozen hours with them, and then you just get to talking. I can't tell you how many times I've been in a guild or a group for an MMO or something else like it, and just gotten to know those people. And the next thing you know, I'm looking forward to every raid night because we're going to hang out afterwards. Or I'm looking forward to the nights where we're not raiding because we're just going to sit in Discord or something and shoot the shit and have a good time and mess around, and it doesn't matter, you know? So people find community, people find a pathway to recovery from whatever they might be dealing with, a pathway out of depression and loneliness. And yeah, I'm not bashful at all about the gamer tag anymore. I mean, I know there's like some memes in regards to it, but it's a huge part of my life. It is what galvanizes my social group of close friends who are what I consider to be my chosen family, if you will. And it's something that we always have. We can always sit down with a board game. We can always sit down, like, with a tabletop RPG. We can always sit down with a video game and have a good time, at least for a little while. Or talk about it. I can't tell you how many nights we've sat there talking about video games or something, just hanging out with each other. It's a lot of times politics is not allowed in my one friend's house, and we're allowed to talk about video games. We're allowed to talk about board games. You know, we can talk about all that kind of stuff. What were you going to say, Twig? I heard you kind of chime in for a second.
Well, I was just going to, in summation of this topic, I was just going to say, you when you asked me at the outset if I wear the gamer tag proudly, and I said yes, and I didn't think about this until right now. It was about maybe a year ago when I went into one of our local mom and pop's retro video stores here,
mm-hmm.
and I'm recognized for one of my YouTube videos, and you're that get off my lawn gaming guy. I my channel is very small,
yeah.
but they know that I'm local, so and they recognized it because I'd been in the store, you know, talking prior to that about Arcade 1-Up,
mm-hmm.
and when I'm recognized and I'm said you're that get off my lawn gaming guy, man, the smile was going from ear to ear at that point.
You're a celebrity now.
Oh yeah, okay.
Well, I mean, to that effect, I've never quite had that experience, but I've spoken at length on other shows about the experience of going to Dragon Con, where, you know, the big draw for me and the other podcasters I used to be involved with on the Giant Size Team Up Network was we went to Dragon Con, and it was like our home away from home every year, and we found a community of people over on the digital media track where we were, which was formerly called the podcasting track, and it was basically people like us, people who like talking about things, and they kind of ran the gamut. Some people were focused on gaming, some were focused on social issues or whatever, but everybody did a show of some sort, and we'd get together and we'd have panels that were fun, like, you know, an entertaining panel, but we had panels that were informative, and this sense of community really cropped up. And for us, it was always about recharging our batteries every year, you know, like hanging out with like-minded people who were trying to create and do this whole podcasting thing or the streaming thing, which had been emerging over recent years. Usually having a lot of the similar interests in everything, whether it be TV, movies, whatever, video games, it's a powerful thing. Community is a powerful thing. And, earning the esteem of your peers goes a long way, right? So for you, in that example, like walking into a retro store and having them recognize you kind of puts hot air in your balloon, you know what I mean?
Oh, of course it did. I was surprised I got my head out the door when I left.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, what do you think, Twig? Should we wrap it up for this week?
That's a wrap. Wish we had one of those little clapboards.
Oh, yep. Clapboards. So don't forget.
You don't know what that is. Tell me.
I know what it is. I was going to make a lewd joke, but I'm just going to move on.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, you're making it clap in your old age. Anyways, clap on, clap off. Anyways, moving on.
Yeah, the clapper.
Next week, we're going to talk about High Score. So we're both going to dig into that and watch it, and we'll bring a little bit of a conversation about it, so you can look forward to that. Please follow us on your social media. I am at Soapbox Klotz on Twitch and Twitter. Twig is Get Off My Lawn Gaming on pretty much everything.
Yep.
On Facebook, you're the founder of the All Things Gaming group, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And come on and join us.
As well as the Arcade 1-Up community, I believe, right? One of them?
Yeah, and oddly enough, Marvel Universe Gazette is still open.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they won't let me close it.
They won't let you close it.
No, I've asked them numerous times.
Yeah. Hey, you guys done with this? No. I mean, we had a similar experience with FTH when the show was over and we moved on to breaking the panel. There were people in the Agents Only Lounge that were like, we're just going to keep this group chat going. And we're like, heck yeah, man, just do it. Do your thing. Keep talking to each other. And they carried on for months afterwards, as far as I remember.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, big thank you to everybody who gives us a listen. The early support has been tremendous. We see you. We see those listens. We really appreciate that. Tell your friends, you know, if you're enjoying the show, spread the word, get it out there. You can support us through the Anchor app if you want to go to our Anchor link and support the show financially. And, you know, then Twig can buy some more games. I would say I could
some
buy
more some shovelware.
Yeah, I would say that I could buy more games too, but I really don't need more. I have over 800 titles on Steam, so I have a backlog that I will never complete. My backlog. I've accepted that.
Oh, do you want to measure numbers of games? I think I've got.
Well, no. I'm not saying that. I'm just like, I just have over 800 titles on Steam that I have played maybe 50 of them. You know what I mean? So it's like, oh boy, one of these days. But anyways, thank you everybody for listening. We will catch you next time. Take care.
Peace out.